The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. On today's action-packed episode, we have assembled a panel of experts that will dissect the recent Lancet retraction of Andrew Wakefield's research into a correlation between autism and the MMR vaccine. So we have pharmacist Scott Guevara, research ethicist Nancy Walton, and author, philosopher, and business ethicist Chris McDonald to explore the shoddy science, questionable ethics, and the repercussions of more than a decade of misinformation. But first, I have an important announcement. Joey Haban, who was on Speaking Up last week to talk about superstition, has reported back on her experiment. You'll remember that she had challenged herself to leave her keys on the table against years of superstitious training that told her that if she did, unspecific, terrible things would befall her. So she flouted conventional wisdom, left her keys on the table, and nothing happened. Her house didn't burn down. No one died. No minor abrasions even. Her dinner mates did get stuck in traffic the next evening, but she doesn't consider it related. So there you have it. Leaving your keys on the table does not necessarily lead to insta-doom. You're welcome. And thanks, Joey.
Hello.
On to this week's Speaking Up. We have Rodrigo De Ligera in the studio with us today. Welcome back, Rodrigo.
Hi, nice to be here.
So you were on Speaking Up a few months ago to discuss IQ, but this time you'd like to talk about the value of basic research.
Yep. There was a recent announcement in Britain where the British government wanted to change the way grants were given. They wanted to require scientists to state what social or economic value the research would have. This caused some prominent scientists in Britain to write a letter of protest. They saw it as being a wrong-headed policy. And it's that the problem is that the public and politicians think that applied science instead of basic science is more important. And I guess I'll explain what applied science is. That's science that's applied to practical problems. For example, creating a specific treatment for a specific disease. Basic science is curiosity-driven science, where you don't actually have a practical application in mind. You're just wondering how the world works, and you go and try to find out.
Right.
The public and the politicians think, well, we have to get some justification, some benefit out of this science. We just can't let scientists do whatever they want. And some people actually believe that government shouldn't even fund science. Private companies should fund science to meet whatever their product development needs are or whatever. And in Britain, there's something called the Russell Group, a group of top universities, and they did a study of the impact of some of their research to assess the difference between applied science and basic science. What happened when they did that? And of one quote here is that of the total financial returns associated with 66 case studies, 74% of the total financial return calculated was associated with commercial projects derived from basic research. 74% basic research. And of the top 10 projects measured by financial returns, 8 were the product of basic research. Now, in the U.S., there's been, these types of politicians as well. There's one famous Senator Proxmire, who used to give out Golden Fleece Awards for scientific research grants that were deemed to be wasteful of public money. And one notorious one he gave away was for the study on the sexual behavior of the screwworm fly. Obviously, it's funny, ridicules, the scientists that were doing this stuff. Wanted to make an example of them. Quite ironically, a few years later, that research led to biological pest control, which helped in the medfly infestation that happened in California, which was doing bad things to their agriculture. I don't know if it's directly related, but a few years after that, he stopped giving out those awards. And there's a famous but apocryphal story about Michael Faraday. He's a scientist who discovered electromagnetic induction, and that's involved in, electric transformers and generators. And supposedly he was one day showing the prime minister what he had done, and the prime minister asked, well, what's the use of this? And then Faraday answered back, well, one day you'll be able to tax it.
Okay, so first of all, that fruit fly research, or sorry, that fly research, that's not the same fruit fly research that Palin had mentioned during her campaign as an example of wasted research funding.
No, Palin's example is actually way worse than this one example I gave. The fruit fly is such an important organism in genetic research. It just, you can't emphasize how important it is in understanding tremendous number of things.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is I understand that maybe government doesn't want to fund basic research. So is this something that private companies would end up doing themselves?
The problem is that there's a market breakdown, I guess you could call it, with private companies doing this for a couple of reasons. It's very difficult to predict what research will become economically significant because it's very hard to make predictions about things that you don't know about yet. If you knew about it, you wouldn't have to research it. So you're just going out on ignorance. And you need to have companies that are big enough and stable enough to do this, because you both have to do a diversity of research, because you never know which one of the studies you're going to do is actually going to bear fruit. And it takes a long time for basic research to pay off. If you're going to be in business only a few years, you're never going to see the rewards of your research. And also, you're always sometimes dependent on getting other science brought in, some other discoveries to combine with yours to be able to produce a product or whatever.
So how big are the potential economic impacts compared to how much money you'd actually put out on something like this?
Well, it varies quite a bit. So I have a few papers, and at the lower end, in agricultural research, you'd get about 20 to 70% of what you put in. But in another example, an older one that I saw about a medical research granting agency in the U.S., they estimated that they could get 10,000% returns on their research. They might have spent $33 million on grants, but got, billions back.
So what are people supposed to do then? I'm sorry, what is the implication? If they're not going to fund basic research, we should just let other countries do the basic research and then we just exploit them?
That's one way of thinking about it, but it actually turns out it's really important to have research done in your own country, because geographical proximity is really important for being able to collaborate with other people. And basically you can't exploit other people's science if you don't have the experts in that same science. And you can't have experts in that science unless they do research in that science. So you're stuck. I mean, people could read these scientific papers, but if they don't understand them, they can't exploit them. Also, in terms of geographical proximity, you could think about Silicon Valley. It's very near to Stanford University, which has an excellent computer science program. And another thing that's kind of counterintuitive as well is that publishing by private companies, if they do research, is actually good for them. You think it wouldn't be because you're giving away secrets to your competitors, but that publishing serves as a signal of your expertise, and it can attract collaborators that will help you create your products.
Okay, so there's a number of good reasons for this. And I'm thinking, you actually sound like a lobbyist right now. So if you were, Rodrigo, if you were lobbying your government for more funding for basic research, what would your argument be, in addition to what you've just said?
Well, I mean, there's also the social impacts of all this research. I mean, we live lives right now that are, the richest person in China maybe a century ago was the emperor. He had tremendous wealth, but he lived in a drafty, cold palace. He was using medicine that was actually killing him, mercury type stuff, all kinds of things that he, with all his wealth, couldn't have, that any normal person in a developed country now has because of science. And other things that basic research gives you is useful knowledge, which I just kind of mentioned, skilled graduates to go into industry if need be, scientific instrumentation and methodologies, which is very useful for companies, doing pharmaceutical research, whatever, they need those instruments. Networks, networking with other people, collaborating, having the ability to problem solve. You train people and they're able to do that because that's what they do all day. And, of course, it could create new companies, new firms. And all these things are things, factors that give positive returns to the investment.
Good information, Rodrigo.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for coming on the show to talk about it. And again, that was Rodrigo de Legera from the Greater Edmonton Skeptical Society. And if you out there have a topic that you'd like to discuss on Speaking Up, do contact us. Send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Give us a bit of information about the subject, and we'll get back to you. And we'll get right back to the show after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia. CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with research ethicist Nancy Walton, philosopher and business ethicist Chris McDonald, and Skeptically Speaking's resident pharmacist, Scott Gavura. And we are going to take an in-depth look at the Lancet's retraction of Andrew Wakefield's study, which he claimed showed a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. As you may remember, Nancy was on the show a while back to discuss research ethics, and Chris was on the show way back in the day when we first began Skeptically Speaking, and he was discussing biotech ethics. So thanks for returning to Skeptically Speaking, everyone. Scott, let's start with you. Just tell us about the study itself.
Okay, well, the study was written by Andrew Wakefield and several other physicians from London's Royal Free Hospital, and it had a fairly bland-sounding title of Ileolymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, Nonspecific Colitis, and Pervasive Developmental Disorder. It was originally published in 1998 in the British medical journal The Lancet, and it discussed a series of children who had developed autism shortly after receiving the measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine. Wakefield had put fiber optic cameras into children and examined their intestines. And the authors proposed a series of fairly devastating events that the vaccine traveled to the intestines. It caused inflammation. And once inflamed, the intestines allowed proteins to enter the bloodstream, travel to the brain, and cause autism. So it was a fairly astonishing claim that the MMR vaccine was causing autism.
Okay, so sorry. Tell me how the study was conducted.
Well, it reported on the cases of 12 anonymous children with developmental disorders who were admitted to a pediatric bowel unit at the Royal Free Hospital between 1996 and 1997.
So what evidence did the study find as conclusive? What supported his claim?
Well, the paper itself doesn't make any actually conclusive findings. It simply identifies what it describes as a series of symptoms that onset suddenly, and the parents of two-thirds of the 12 children blamed MMR or indicated that MMR had been given recently in the time-wise related to when the symptoms started.
So now other researchers attempted to replicate his findings, and what were their results?
Well, obviously, the study created quite a bit of stir, and there was quite a bit of research into looking at the issues that Wakefield identified, but no credible research have been able to duplicate his findings. There hasn't been any instance where the measles vaccine has been found in the intestines of autistic children. There's no evidence of brain-damaging proteins in the blood. There's no evidence that patients that receive MMR are more likely to develop autism than those that hadn't, and the laboratory that was used to detect the measles vaccine virus in the Wakefield paper was shown to have significant problems in its methodology.
Okay, now you mentioned credible researchers, that no credible researchers have been able to replicate his results. What does that mean?
Well, I think that if You can find papers that will suggest that there is a relationship between the MMR vaccine or vaccines in general and autism. But when we look at researchers who are not connected with Wakefield, there hasn't been any researchers that have been able to duplicate the exact findings that he had. And one of the hallmarks of the quality of scientific data is that it needs to be independently verified, and that hasn't occurred with the Wakefield's findings.
Right. Now, Nancy, there were also ethical issues with the paper, and just it's not only the fact that the claims or that the study wasn't able to be replicated, but pretty serious ethical issues.
That's sort of a loaded question, because it's not quite sure where you would start when you start talking about them. I think probably the most one of the most important issues is that, you know, an ethics review board, as it seems, never really approved the study in the form it did. And while that's an important sort of logistic issue, what it means is that no one ever really evaluated from an ethical perspective whether it was ethical to do the kinds of high-risk procedures they did on these, you know, kids with developmental disabilities. So, you know, the big issue is that I think there's a lot of mystery around whether these these kids were actually patients, or if they were brought there, you know, purposely for Dr. Wakefield's purposes. But I think the biggest issue is that he exposed children to risky procedures, including lumbar punctures, including, you know, various scans that exposed them to some degree of radiation, anesthetics, scopes, painful, risky procedures. And no one who could have either assessed this or monitored it really knew about it.
Right.
I think, you know, there's sort of other ethical issues, including, you know, the conflict of interest that he obviously had, which is a whole other discussion. But, you know, there's ethical issues around the selection of patients, you know, any sort of, and that's one of those issues that's a little bit research ethics and a little bit research integrity in terms of gathering evidence. But, you know, the main ethical issue is just exposing kids to this kind of risk when all the other issues that were in place existed.
Now, maybe, can you just touch on, you mentioned the conflict of interest.
I can, yeah. And there's a number of sort of areas that are clearly and, I guess, grossly conflicts of interest for Andrew Wakefield. One is that, and the main one is that he was in active collaboration prior to the publication of the article in The Lancet. He was in active collaboration with a lawyer whose last name was Barr, and the lawyer and he together collaborated. It wasn't like Andrew Wakefield was an expert witness, but they collaborated to start a class action suit against the manufacturers of the MMR vaccine. And this was kind of, you know, in place before anything was published, and there was a lot of money exchanged. Andrew Wakefield was paid a significant amount of public funds and then was paid an ongoing, you know, significant salary, mm-hmm. very significant salary. And so he, you know, he had an obvious conflict of interest there. And there's also there's evidence that he also, before the Lancet article was published, he successfully got a patent for a single measles vaccine, so not the combined MMR, but he patented a form of a single measles vaccine. So that's a conflict of interest, obviously, that if, you know, he publishes an article that says the MMR vaccine is unsafe, and instead something like a non-combined vaccine, like a single vaccine, would be safer, he would stand to make a lot of money from that.
So once the paper was published, Scott, what kind of impact did it have? Like, for example, how quickly did vaccination rates drop?
Initially, the vaccination rates started to drop fairly noticeably, fairly shortly after the publication and the resultant media attention, the vaccination rates bottomed out about 3 years later, and they have been rebounding since 2004.
Okay, so when did the measles outbreak start again?
Well, there's always been, if we're speaking about England in specific, there's a few cases of measles every year that occur mainly due to imported cases, but there has been a resurgence in measles because of the decrease in vaccinations, which dropped, as I said, to a low of 80%, and in some parts of London down to 50%. And in 2006, there was one measles death, which was the first death from acute measles since 1992.
Now, that's in the UK. What did we see in Canada or the US?
I don't have the exact statistics for Canada and the U.S., but certainly there have been outbreaks of measles in the United States, I know for certain. I don't think that the drop has been as significant with respect to MMR as it has been in the United Kingdom. But there has been quite a bit of concern, but not to the level and to the extent that occurred in the United Kingdom.
Right. Now, Jenny McCarthy has said something to the effect, and I don't have her quotes here, but to the effect that measles aren't a big deal, that autism is worse. So, Scott, maybe, sorry to pick on you, Scott, you get a lot of questions. Can you explain what the measles is and what it can actually do? Because it actually seems that since we started vaccinating for it and rates have gone down, people don't seem to remember what it was like before.
Yeah, I guess that's a shocking, surprising comment. In 2004, according to the World Health Organization, about 454,000 people worldwide died from the measles, often due to secondary complications. And, you know, despite a vaccine being available, measles is still the leading cause of vaccine-preventable death in the world. And it's a highly contagious viral disease. It affects mostly children. It's transmitted by droplets from the nose or mouth. Starts with a fever, runny nose, bloodshot eyes, white spots in the back of the mouth. Several days later, a rash develops. There's really no specific treatment, and overall, most people recover within 2 to 3 weeks. But particularly in malnourished children, people with reduced immunity, measles can cause serious complications, including blindness, encephalitis, severe diarrhea, ear infections, pneumonia. Now, before the vaccine, and as I pointed out, a lot of people still don't have access to the vaccine, measles would occur in cycles every 2 to 3 years, and, you know, 300,000 to 400,000 cases annually. And, you know, about 1 in 20 would get an ear infection, 1 in 25 have respiratory problems, 1 in 200 have convulsions, 1 to about 1 in 1,000 get meningitis or encephalitis, and the Canadian statistics say about 1 in 3,000 to about 5,000 die from measles. Now, measles elimination within the population should be possible because a vaccine is available, and there's no way it can't stay anywhere if it's not being covered by humans. But when we look at England, because of the Wakefield paper, measles is now endemic in the population, so it's back out there. It's still considered to be under control in North America.
So when Ms. McCarthy says something like autism is worse than measles, potentially that's not the case.
Well, I think that's very difficult to say. I mean, I don't want to understate the difficulty and the challenges that that autism presents to families and to the child themselves. But certainly, measles is a terribly significant illness. But there really is no relationship between the vaccine and autism at all. So it's not really a debate that we should be having about whether one is worse than the other when there is no relationship between a measles vaccine and autism.
Oh, I'm just thinking the death part. The potential death part of measles.
Well, there's no question that measles is a very can have very significant consequences. And we look at the vaccine, setting aside the autism issue, the vaccine is exceptionally safe. The major problem that can be encountered, which is exceptionally rare, is allergic reaction, anaphylactic allergy, which is exceptionally rare to the vaccine. Overall, the vaccine is exceptionally safe. And it has tremendously beneficial effects. The World Health Organization estimates that they've saved, they're vaccinating they've vaccinated nearly 700 million children against measles, and they estimate it's prevented about 4.3 million measles deaths in less than a decade.
We have, let me see, an email question, actually, about Ms. McCarthy. The email is from Keith T.
What impressed me about Jenny McCarthy's page was the statistics showing a correlation between the incidence of autism and the number of vaccinations given to children across countries. It looks as though autism is strongly associated with the number of vaccinations. Are those statistics bogus, or can they be explained in another way?
Who would like to take that one?
I did look at that paper, so I can discuss it if no one else wants to.
All right.
It's an interesting paper, which is it looks interesting and it looks compelling until you look more closely at the data and you realize the cherry picking that's gone on here. One of the difficulties is comparing infant mortality rates between the United States and other countries, where there's different criteria used in different countries. The paper compares autism rates among countries to show that the United States has the highest rates, you know, saying, which implies, oh, look at the number of vaccines. But the paper doesn't compare for the same time periods. So it looks at, you know, data from 1997 in other countries or for children born in 1979. But what's really, I think, probably the most compelling and surprising information is that the prevalence data from Canada and the United Kingdom, which have, you know, comparable prevalence rates for autism, but different vaccine schedules and different numbers of vaccines, mm-hmm. that's omitted.
Chris, it's your turn. There are entire industries that have sprung up because of this supposed controversy. Homeopathic vaccines, for one. Herbal remedies. The class action vaccination-related injury industry. There's a liability set up for these kind of lawsuits, correct? No, it might not be in Canada. I know in the States there is a liability fund set up for vaccine-related injury. Class action suits.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I don't know much about it.
Okay, we don't have anything like that here that you're aware of?
Not that I know of, but okay. I'm not sure.
So how do you think that this has affected the public's view of other pharmaceutical products? You know, if doubt is cast on one.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the things that this has done is it sort of played into people's pre-existing skepticism about the pharmaceutical industry. And, to a certain extent, the skepticism about the pharmaceutical industry has been well-earned by that industry. I mean, it's got its problems, for sure. And so I think a range of fairly high-profile scandals in Big Pharma have led people to a place where they sort of where it's not very hard to get them convinced that yet another big pharmaceutical product, something like vaccines, isn't all it's cracked up to be. And so I think it's unfortunate that, you know, you have a combination of, you have a background condition in which people are already primed to be skeptical of Big Pharma, and then you have a set of parents of autistic kids saying, well, you know, the story that Big Pharma and its, you know, supporters and fans give us about autism, which is that, you know, autism is this complex, multifactorial disease that we don't understand very well, and that vaccines are you know, a fairly safe technology, that doesn't coincide with my personal experience as a parent of an autistic child, as well as this much simpler theory of Wakefield and his supporters that, hey, it was just, you know, it has a simple causal explanation rooted in this product produced by the big evil pharmaceutical companies.
So why do people actually see these two industries as being so different? And by industries, I mean Big Pharma and Big Alt Health.
Well, I think as I said, you know, you can't deny that there have been some pretty bad stories about the pharmaceutical industry, and they've been very, very well publicized. And I think the thing that people aren't distinguishing is between the, you know, particular actions of particular companies on particular days, which have admittedly been problematic, versus, you know, and so they've somehow been equating that with the notion that the entire industry and the entire science that it's founded on is somehow, intrinsically questionable, which just doesn't follow, right? I mean, in order to believe the sort of conspiracy theories, you have to not only believe that everyone at all of the pharmaceutical companies is evil and corrupt, but you also have to believe that every health professional and every scientist, I mean, there's this massive web of interlocking knowledge that sort of makes it clear that the vaccine autism link isn't there, we don't have any support for it. And people just, I think, find it pretty easy to jump from those particular instances of wrongdoing to the idea that that somehow this entire web of belief, this entire sort of interlocking chain of knowledge, somehow just doesn't add up to what it should be.
So let's talk about the status of the paper now, because we've talked about all the impacts from it being written in the first place, but now the Lancet has decided to retract the paper. So are they basically saying that they never should have published it in the first place? Who wants to handle this question?
Sure, I can. I don't have much insight into this, but, you know, no, they're not saying that they never published it. I mean, they're certainly saying, the one quote that I read from the editor of Lancet, which, you know, is a very high respected journal in the medical field, the one quote that I read from him said that, you know, he would, and it's an understandably very, you know, I'm not sure what the word is, vague quote, saying that he would take greater care when looking at articles, submitted articles with such small samples. So, you know, that's not really addressing the numerous issues there are with this.
Right.
But I think that they've retracted it, you know, quite late. There certainly was an opportunity to retract it, you know, a couple of years ago in 2004, or even, you know, at the very beginning, to say, this is such a small sample, you know, to ask some questions. And most journals, and The Lancet is one of them, has very strict review processes, and their peer review processes. So Andrew Wakefield's article would have conceivably been sent out to, you know, three or four reviewers in the field of autism or gastric diseases, vaccination, and it would have been reviewed by people like that. So, you know, to some degree, the editors depend on those reviewers to give feedback, because an editor can't be an expert in everything.
Right.
So at some point, you know, I think The Lancet, they've taken responsibility as much as they can, and I'm not sure what more they can do. I think, like I said, I think they've retracted it a bit late, but I think the retraction was an important thing to do. And the actual words they use in the retraction, I don't have it right in front of me, were suitably vague, though, and people weren't really happy. They wanted more, but I'm not sure it's quite up to the editor of the Lancet Journal to, you know, say everything. The retraction speaks for itself, and that's sort of the headlines. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
you did. Did anyone else have anything to add on that?
I think that the Lancet should have retracted the piece in 2004 when 10 of the 13 authors pulled their name off the paper, when it was clear about the undisclosed conflict of interest and the lack of ethics approval for the paper. At that point, the entire paper and the conclusions were highly questionable, and I think at that point the Lancet should have acted to retract the paper in its entirety.
So on what grounds would a medical journal usually retract a paper?
Well, retractions can occur for a number of reasons. Where there's clear evidence of fraud, a paper is usually retracted. Even if the distortion of data is small for any reason, there's often immediate questions about the overall integrity of the data. And that's when it's typically the paper may be retracted. For example, the conclusions might have been based on faulty logic or computation. There may have been accidents in the experimentation. And publications can be retracted for all of these reasons, not just fraud, but also honest error as well.
So how often does that actually happen?
Well, there are, as I said, there's a number of different reasons for retractions to occur. They're not all that common. I think it's important to point out that when the when a paper is retracted, they're essentially saying that it should be ignored, and it's saying that it will be marked as retracted in Medline. In a paper world, in the past, that would have been that it could even have included saying, you know, take your journal paper, tear the pages out, and destroy it. But in an internet world, that's impossible. The journal, that article, will last forever online, virtually.
So, is there anything valid in the paper at all? Can we take anything from the Wakefield study? Nancy, you laughed. Now you have to answer.
I did. I think there's, you know, it sounds trite, but there's lessons to be learned from it all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's anything clinical to take from it at all, because it's just, it's very shabby science at best. And, you know, you had asked Scott earlier, were there any studies that replicated the results, you know, in any way or form? And there haven't been. There has, in fact, though, been a number of, you know, significantly large studies saying, you know, completely refuting the link between the vaccine and autism and, you know, various gastric disorders. So I think the thing to be taken from the article is that that's the only article that, you know, that's the only, quote unquote, I'm using this term loosely, research study that shows a link. And, you know, the thing that we should take from it is that, you know, there really is no proven link.
Well, and this being said, now, there was only one study, but it seems like this study was basically, you know, the catalyst for the modern anti-vaccination movement. Would that be accurate?
I think to some degree it wasn't the article so much, from my understanding, but the subsequent press releases and press conferences and public speaking engagements that Andrew Wakefield did, you know, kind of, you know, creating a mob mentality and, you know, getting people on his side. And they had, you know, various television and radio vignettes with mothers and children, and, you know, they're very compelling. So I think the article, most people, I would suspect, and I'm making a huge assumption here, a lot of people who are probably anti-vaccine probably haven't read, you know, the article beginning to end. Mm-hmm. However, they, you know, and a lot of the websites supporting Andrew Wakefield, you know, say a lot of things like, I just trust him, and I, you know, if he says that, then this is true. So I think the article, you know, getting something published in Lancet is a significant accomplishment. So that sort of adds to, at that point, it added to his credibility and allowed him to say at a press conference, you know, in various speaking engagements, here's my article, you know, and with a number of co-authors, you know, all accomplished people in this field. So it kind of, you know, equipped him with credibility.
Chris, did you want to add anything? I feel like we're leaving you out.
Well, I think the other thing that this article and the press conference that followed it and the people who took it up early, I mean, I think one of the important things it did was that it sort of gave, it served as sort of the catalyst for, as you say, this sort of, or at least a certain portion of the autism treatment industry. And I think, you know, whether, you know, you can interpret anybody who's promoting any sort of alternative therapy, whether it's different methods for treating different sort of non-standard methods of treating autism or any other kind of alternative therapy, you know, you can sort of roughly cluster the companies or individuals into two groups, not necessarily mutually exclusive. On the one hand, you're going to have the sort of utter scam artist who is going to be able to use a study like the Wakefield study as sort of that, as something to, as a leg to stand on kind of thing, to say, look, my snake oil makes sense because, of course, they're not going to call it snake oil. My treatment right. makes sense because, look, there's this scientific study, and after all, it was published in The Lancet. And then on the other hand, you have people who are just sort of merely maybe well-intentioned but misguided or maybe overly credulous, who are going to be able to say, well, look, there's this an actual scientist publishing a peer-reviewed paper in a respected journal, and so, you know, I could help by you know, creating, you know, chelation therapy or some other form of therapy that apparently is rooted in this very, very slim evidence. And so I think, you know, there's nothing wrong in principle with commercializing, with, you know, with taking a bit of science, taking a piece of actual verified science and putting it into action. I mean, commercialization is kind of how, for the most part, how science ends up affecting our lives. But I think when companies or individuals commercialize science, they need to be pretty sure that the science they're commercializing is pretty solid. And that's not to say that it has to be unanimous science. I mean, I can imagine respectable businesses built on either side of a genuine scientific controversy. But in this case, there wasn't a genuine scientific controversy. There was an initial titillating bit of anecdotal evidence that got accepted as a peer-reviewed paper, and it was never a genuine scientific controversy. And so I think it was just, in some cases, severely misguided, and in other cases, actually unethical to base businesses on this article.
Do you have any idea of the scope of industries or businesses that sort of popped up after?
I can't really put a number on it. I mean, it's clear if you spend any time at all, sort of even just casually Googling around, the is that a verb now? Googling around.
It absolutely is. I use it all the time.
It is.
The autism treatment industry is clearly huge, and that ranges from, you know, everything from, you know, fairly well behavioral, fairly well understood or fairly well established behavioral interventions through to all the weirdest stuff you can imagine. And I mean, in part, the scope of the autism treatment industry is broad and varied because the you know, probably for two reasons. On the one hand, autism is so poorly understood, and on the other hand, parents end up so incredibly desperate over, you know, trying their best to help their kids. And so the industry seems large. I don't have numbers. Nancy may know a bit more about the numbers, or not. But it seems certainly that it's led to a flourishing of, well, here's a whole new set of concerns, and you know, once you've got a flaky scientific foundation to build upon, who knows how many flaky quasi-scientific remedies you can come up with.
Absolutely. So now I'm wondering, what was the effect on vaccine producers? Because, you know, press releases get done around something like this. How are they affected?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously, in terms of how they're affected, there was, partly there was an unfortunate reduction in demand for exactly the reasons that Scott pointed out. I mean, if fewer parents are taking their kids to get vaccinated, this, other things being equal, amounts to a reduction in demand. But there were also things that, and again, this is something that maybe Scott could say a word or two about, but the removal of thimerosal from at least some vaccines, perhaps unnecessarily, because it was suspected that thimerosal, which is a form of, which is sort of a, again, I'm not the scientist on the team here, but it was is basically a mercury compound, was removed from at least some vaccines, probably unnecessarily from what I understand. And so there was some cost borne there. Part of the cost, of course, the cost directly being borne by pharmaceutical companies. But in the end, you know, costs to changes in formulation are going to be borne by the customer, whether that's individual patients or whether that's governments and hospitals.
Scott, did you want to follow up anywhere there?
Yeah, you know, it's. I think it's difficult to say. I don't know the numbers. I think that the reality is that you know, measles is still a huge issue in worldwide, and you know, the World Health Organization has worked to eliminate measles through mass vaccination programs. But even today, one in four children never receive a single dose of measles vaccine. So while there was probably, there was certainly a drop off in vaccinations in Europe, for sure, in the United Kingdom and in North America, I think worldwide there's still a huge number of children who don't get the vaccine, don't even get one shot of the vaccine. And so there's still a huge demand and need to get the vaccine. I think if the impact on the companies, I think it'd be hard to say, because it's still a huge effort by World Health Organization to control measles in the rest of the world.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we look at the increasing focus on interactivity at science and skeptical conferences. On Speaking Up, Skepticamp founder Reed Asau talks about the creation of the Skepticamp interactive conference system. Then, Science Online 2010 organizer Bora Zikovic discusses the evolution of the conference model and his experience putting together a massive multi-day gathering of scientists and science enthusiasts. Science gets interactive. Next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
So welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're here with pharmacist Scott Gavura, research ethics expert Nancy Watson, and business ethicist Chris McDonald, talking about Andrew Wakefield's research and how it impacted more than just vaccination rates. But let me do one quick reminder from the Independent Investigations Group, who were on the show last week. Regan Trainor will be doing the preliminary demonstration for their $50,000 challenge at 4 p.m. Pacific time tomorrow. The event will be live on Ustream. And I watched their last one, and it was fascinating. Long, but fascinating. Check out iigwest.com for details. So, all of you, does Wakefield have a history of poor research, or is the MMR autism link sort of an exception to his research? Nancy?
I don't know if Scott could answer that more than I could. I haven't really sought out or looked for other things by him. Scott, I don't know, do you know more about that than I do?
No, not a whole lot. I haven't looked at his. He has a few dozen publications in PubMed, but I haven't looked at. I do notice that another publication just fairly recently was withdrawn, although I'm not sure of the reason why.
I think this is Chris. Can I add something, Des?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just one thing that occurred to me today as I was doing some more reading about the case was that Wakefield has just resigned from the autism treatment center in Texas, where he's been employed for the last few years. He just resigned in the last couple of days, and it was interesting to note that because he doesn't have a medical license in the U.S., his job description in Texas was as a researcher. So he's working full time as a researcher, presumably working on this particular hypothesis of his, and yet, despite several years working as a researcher, we haven't seen, what you would expect to see. If there's a strong hypothesis here, you'd expect to see a string of publications that at least go some distance towards validating this hypothesis. And in a sense, the fact that between us, I'm not an expert on the literature. But the fact that between the three of us, and we've paid between us a fair bit of attention to this issue, if we haven't seen, a string of positive peer-reviewed publications out of Wakefield, despite sort of a full-time research job
exactly.
for the last few years, that's not a good sign.
Yeah, it's Nancy. Can I just add to Chris's point that, typically an article being published with only, a very small sample like that, it isn't, that terribly, terribly unusual. But what it usually is, a serendipitous finding or like something found by happenstance that needs to be, that can be reported and that's important. And the next logical thing, or the next logical step, would be that, that researcher probably, if they have a significant amount of funding and a designation as a full-time researcher, would be doing, a large trial to sort of test out this serendipitous finding. And that's never, that's never happened.
Now, we have an email question here.
Although the study has been retracted, there may be more long-term effects that may be hard to predict. The listener links to an article titled "Anti-Vaccine Studies Also Threaten Homeland Security," which talks about the impact of the anti-vaccine community on domestic preparedness against biological threats, be they natural or man-made. What must be done to correct this continuing problem?
Who would like that one?
Well, I can say a little bit. I mean, I think... it's very hard to know what the long-term effect of a study like this is. I think certainly it's quite certain that kids have gotten sick and died because of it. I think it's you know, very likely that a whole bunch of kids with autism and or autism spectrum disorders have been subjected to probably inappropriate treatment because of it. In the long run, I think that the, probably the greater harm is to things like people's trust in institutions, in public health organizations, and in, you know, the World Health Organization, and in the pharmaceutical industry. And as I've already said, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has some legitimate problems, and there are, you know, you don't necessarily automatically believe everything the pharmaceutical industry says, and that's not, you know, nobody thinks that. But if it, you know, if a study like this and its promotion leads people to conclude that, you know, this whole vaccination thing, you know, which is actually probably, you know, one of the greatest achievements of modern medicine, if it leads people to believe that it's somehow a scam or somehow an evil thing, then I think an enormous amount of long-term damage is done.
We have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. This girl, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Basically, I think the problem at the core of the issue here is, why is it that Jenny McCarthy gets so much play versus the scientific community?
It's a very good question, caller.
Well, for one thing, it's a lot easier for Jenny McCarthy to get on Oprah than it is for your average scientist. I mean, she's got fame working on her side. I mean, I think she's got two things. She's got fame and charisma. I mean, she got famous not just for her physical presence, but for her charisma and her ability to sort of command an audience and to command a camera. And also, she's the mother of an autistic child, and she's able to speak from firsthand experience and to speak the language of other parents of autistic children in the way that the average scientist just isn't going to be able to do. I mean, the average scientist is going to speak in slow, cautious scientific terms in a way that's going to seem probably quite foreign to the average person, whereas Jenny McCarthy can speak from the heart, which on the one hand is a good thing. It would just be better if she spoke from the brain a little more.
Anyone else want to add on to that?
Yeah, and Scott, I think it's easier to give black and white responses and black and white answers versus the nuanced scientific responses that, you know, good scientists would give around what the data says.
Now we have another website question.
In 2002, Wakefield said, what precipitated this crisis was the removal of the single vaccine, the removal of choice, and that is what is called caused the furor, because the doctors, the gurus, are treating the public as though they are some kind of moronic mass who cannot make an informed decision for themselves. The fact of the matter is that many, but not all, will not make an informed decision, and this can affect herd immunity, should there be a choice.
Contentious question. I'll turn that over to Chris.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult in a practical, you know, practically speaking, to force vaccinations. I mean, just like any other medical treatment. I mean, anytime we start talking about forcing, it starts to raise the specter of, you know, armed men showing up at the door with the, you know, the guys with the guns in the front and the guys with the needles behind, and so it starts to seem pretty nightmarish if you literally start talking about forcing. But I think there's probably, you know, certainly we shouldn't, it shouldn't socially be regarded as optional. I mean, I think ethically speaking, there's a pretty strong obligation to have your kid vaccinated, both for the sake of your own kid and for the sake of your neighbor's kid. But I think there's a huge range of government actions that range from sort of encouragement through to promotion, through to rewards, through to whatever, that can basically get across the idea that, look, this is not optional, even if we don't take it quite as far as literally forcing people to be vaccinated.
Now, I guess we're getting close to the end of the show. And to tell you the truth, I've been reading a lot of, you know, on the science and skeptical websites about the Lancet retraction. But in mainstream media, I haven't really heard about it. So do you think other people are hearing about it? And do you think they care? Scott?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, I did see some press in mainstream media about it. And I think that's positive. And I think that what I think is the best thing that we're finally seeing is what's disappeared is the false balance, which is the in some of the presses, in some of the reports are now basically calling a spade and indicating that there really is no controversy. And they're not bringing in that false balance with allowing someone to speak who claims that there still exists some academic or scientific merit in the Wakefield paper. So that seems to have disappeared in some of the mainstream coverage, which I think is good to see.
Anyone else?
Well, I think, I mean, to a certain extent, yeah, the retraction really hasn't got as much play as you would like, but I think that's kind of a well-known pattern. I mean, retractions of scientific findings or quasi-scientific findings, as the case may be, just seldom make the news. I mean, there are lots of cases in the past where, you know, something frightening or interesting or even hopeful and promising has been announced, and that makes headlines, and then a few months later, a retraction gets issued by a journal or by a scientist, and you know, if it gets reported at all, like it's reported on page 36 of the newspaper. It's just not as intrinsically interesting news-wise.
Now we are pretty much out of time, but I do want to end. I want to end with an email comment from Lee in Winnipeg. I'm so happy you're doing an episode on this. I've been trying to write about this story in my university newspaper in Winnipeg, but they apparently won't print it. I said that I would even take full responsibility for any litigation as a result, but still nothing. They tell me all this crap about how people may be upset and it's a sensitive subject, etc. But if angry parents learn that they can stop the spread of diseases by vaccinating their kids, then it's worth it to upset some people. Thanks to Scott Guevara in his first appearance on Skeptically Speaking, and Phil Plait's numerous articles on it, as well as many others, I now know why it's not just dangerous for children not to get it, but it's dangerous for people who come into contact with those non-vaccinated children. I don't care if anti-vaxxers put themselves at risk, but I care that they spread viruses to others. It's bad enough that they're spreading memes to no end. Thanks for your email, Lee. And it is a sensitive subject, but one that desperately requires discussion and a lot more discussion than we can provide in an hour, obviously. So thanks so much to Nancy Walton, Chris McDonald, and to Scott Guevara for being here today. You can find more from Nancy at researchethics.ca/blog. Chris can be found at businessethics.ca/blog, and Scott, as usual, is at sciencebasedpharmacy.wordpress.com. And you can find more from us at skepticallyspeaking.com, as well as links to the show or to Facebook, to our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.